Our next speaker is Christine Vogt-William. I hope I pronounced that correctly. A native of Singapore, Christine Vogt-William studied English, German, and psychology at the University of Essen, Germany. Vogt-William has published on South Asian diasporic women's literature from the US, Canada, England, and the Caribbean. She's the co-editor of and contributor to Disturbing Bodies, an essay collection on artistic and literary representations of deviant bodies. Vogt-William moved to the U.S. in June 2008 and is currently visiting scholar at the Department of Women's Studies at Emory University, Georgia. She currently divides her time between Atlanta and the University of Münster, Germany, where she teaches currently. Thank you. And her paper today is entitled Mixed Race Relations and Dugla Identities in Indo-Caribbean Women's Fiction. Do you want to use that one?
Yes. Is this switched on? Can everybody hear me? Thank you very much. Just a slight amendment to my biographical note there. I just moved back to Frankfurt, Germany at the end of April this year, so I'm currently in a moment of transition. Yes, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak here. Without further ado, I'll just carry on. The Indo-Caribbean histories in Trinidad and Guyana are intimately linked with Afro-Caribbean histories, the most obvious connection being that the Indian indentured laborers were brought to these countries to replace slave labor after the abolition of slavery in 1834. In the following, I examine mixed race relations amongst these two groups and Dugla identities in the novels of two Indo-Trinidadian Canadian writers, The Swinging Bridge by Ramabai Espinay and He Drowned She in the Sea by Shani Mutu. Now, due to time restraints, I have left out Unia Kempadu's Buxton Spice, but I will welcome discussions later. Hence, the main sociocultural context to be considered here is Trinidadian. Fraught race relations were often the base for interethnic hostilities, where both Afro-Trinidadian and Indo-Trinidadian cultural frameworks functioned within the logic of the racial stereotype in dominant European racial discourse. In her analysis of Olive Senior's The Arrival of the Snake Woman, set in Jamaica, Velma Pollard traces the more common prejudices entertained by both ethnic groups of each other. You'll see that on your quote one on your handout. Indians described Afro-Caribbeans as lazy, argumentative, wasteful of their resources, and indulging only in sport and alcohol. Besides being held by Afro-Caribbeans to be miserly, Indians were also criticized for their cooking and eating habits, language, and heathen religion. Jeremy Poynting remarks on the similarity of these stereotypes in Trinidadian and Guyanese contexts, seeing their basis in, I quote, attempts of Europeans in the 19th century to justify the indenture systems and in Afro-Creole fears of Indian competition, unquote. Thus, rifts and tensions between African and Indian communities in the Caribbean were affected especially by the colonial plantocracy and missionaries who, fearing sedition, discouraged interracial solidarity and cooperation. And yet, there were Afro-Caribbeans and Indo-Caribbeans who managed to effect relations across racial boundaries and class and color bars, creating Duglarized sensibilities. Once a pejorative term in Hindi meaning bastard, Dugla is used nowadays to designate those of African and Indian parentage in the Caribbean, thus manifesting a hybridized form of geopolitical belonging. The figure of the Dugla was considered by many bourgeois Indians as a potential threat to Indian cultural coherence and by extension to a powerful political lobby under the demographic category of East Indian, illustrating Viranjani Munasinghe's observation that the power-danger complex afforded by the mixings of unequals posed significant challenges and thereby needed to be harnessed by nation builders and domesticated into various hegemonic forms as nationalist narratives. This is in quote two on your handout. The Dugla, the product of the mixings of unequals, thus engenders anxiety, encompassing discourses of illegitimacy which haunt Indo-Caribbean history. This anxiety can be read as a consequence of migrations across geopolitical borders and cultural spaces, which contributed to the destabilization of boundaries of race, class, and caste. Anxieties about cultural authenticity were rendered more complex when the comparative autonomy of the first waves of female Indian indentures served to reevaluate gender roles and expectations, whereby Patricia Muhammad observes, "The specter before Indian men was the loss of a separate Indian identity, one which was linked to the notion of ethnic purity." unquote. Additional complications arose through Indo-Caribbean's own exclusionary agenda of demonizing mixed descendants of Afro and Indo-Caribbean ancestry. This exacerbated the existing cultural othering experienced by Indians from Afro-Caribbean communities, which informed their own self-perception as not quite belonging to the nation, since they were latecomers to a thoroughly creolized colonial society. According to Shalini Puri, Dugla poetics could provide a vocabulary, a language for delegitimized hybrid racial identities, while also offering ways to reframe the problematics of African and Indian politics in Trinidad, informed by race, gender, and sexual relations. Gender roles and expectations from both Indo-Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean communities inform and complicate these relations. While Indo-Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean women's agendas and agencies were often truncated in representation to favor more dominant African-centered social codes informed by masculine heteronormativity, current literary and cultural productions by women from both groups evince the development of an increasingly creolized consciousness which challenged racial, gender, and class binaries. The fraught transcultural alliances between Afro-Caribbeans and Indo-Caribbeans, which I examine in my paper today, seem to occur most frequently between Afro-Caribbean men and Indo-Caribbean women. Perhaps we can talk a little later about why it doesn't necessarily happen the other way around in literature. Shalini Puri remarks on the appropriateness of the genre of the novel as a site to address the interrogation of hybrid identities with a view to engendering a Caribbean feminist Dugla poetics. Since literature is, I quote, a medium that is not understood to be exclusively the cultural capital of Indo or Afro-Trinidadians, unquote. Ramabai Espinay's novel, The Swinging Bridge, addresses not just Afro-Creole and Indo-Caribbean intimacies, but also the consequences of white sexual exploitation of Indian women's sexualities, suffered by African women slaves before them, as well as Indian men's patriarchal policing of Indian women's sexualities. Shani Mutu's narrative, He Drowned, She in the Sea, addresses the concept of Indian female agency as being nurtured in the context of a Dugla relationship, which is not necessarily of biological origins. At the same time, the rifts between the African and Indian communities are rendered even more complex by the intra-community dynamics of class consciousness. Mixed-race relationships in both novels convey the main protagonists, both men and women, own politically creolized affirmative stances which issue discrimination based on racial, on race, class, and gender. The Swinging Bridge. Ramabai's narrative crisscrosses diasporic histories and contemporaneities while addressing racial prejudices, gendered violence, and transcultural transgressions in four generations of women in an Indo-Trinidadian family. Remembering incidents from her Trinidadian childhood, the main protagonist, Mona, questions the necessity of keeping Indian women in Trinidad under the Indo-Caribbean community's constant surveillance. This is quote 5 on your handout. Mona comes to realize that as a woman, her own political stance of creolized acceptance and integration of the diverse communities poses a threat to her father's self-perception as an Indian in 1950s Trinidad who does not quite belong. Besides being wary of her father's potential for violence, Mona encounters patriarchal censure as a child from the community itself. Riding home in a taxi from a school event, she is subjected to a tirade from an Indian taxi driver who scrutinizes the child's dress. This is quote 6 on your handout. Here, the young girl's dress is read as indicative of her supposed future promiscuity and makes her a faceless target for Indian public male disapproval. Indian masculinity appears threatened by the autonomy exhibited by Indian women who choose Creole men as their partners. At the age of 18, Mona does indeed become romantically involved with Bree, a quote, a red boy, an obvious mixture of African and other races. Her paternal grandmother, Lily, sees her by chance in a cafe with Bree and quietly mentions it to Mona's mother, Muddy. The older women are conscious of the changing times where younger Indian women are more willing to transgress boundaries to claim their agency. They take Mona's part and are anxious to spare the girl her father's rage. However, Mona breaks off the relationship with Bree when he slaps her in public during a playful argument among friends. Bree's aggression reminds her of her father's violence towards her, of male violence towards women in general. The quiet manner in which Grandma Lil unobtrusively attempts to warn her granddaughter shows that she remembers her own transgression with her white Indian lover, Davy, and the violent public humiliation she was subjected to as a young woman from her father, Joshua. Mona's mother tells the story of Lily's forbidden love. This is quote 7 on your handout. The forcible killing of Lily's and Davy's unborn daughter preserves Lily's father's honor and public reputation, while at the same time inculcating a subversive edge in Lily herself. She is described as a strong woman, a virago, who, while maintaining an outward show of respectability in her arranged marriage, still mourns her lost love and child. The dead child is named Daisy and is later commemorated by Davy, Lily's former lover, who gives the name to his second daughter by his arranged marriage to another Indian woman. Mona's discovery of Grandma Lily's transgressive love affair is made even more poignant when her cousin Bess in Trinidad reveals that Davy is her grandfather and that the second Daisy is her mother. Bess's connection to Grandma Lil is further cemented biologically since her father is Lily's youngest son, Sweetie Boy. Bess is adopted by Lily when both her parents die. Thus, Bess's own illegitimacy is expunged due to Lily's claiming of her as a replacement for her love child with Davy, and thus provides her with a legitimate social context to reinvent herself. Bess opens avenues for Mona to recover her Indian maternal genealogy, while also allowing her opportunities to ponder her own contemporary diasporic situation as an Indo-Caribbean woman living in Canada. Mona's Norwegian inability to root herself in any cultural context and cultivate lasting relationships is in direct contrast to Bess's confidence in her Indian Creole heritage and the space she has carved out for herself in Trinidad. Bess's comfortable self-perception as a Creolized subject is buttressed by her relationship to a young Dugla man, Rajesh, a quote, a Rastafarian with almost floor-length dreadlocks, unquote. Mona witnesses open hostility towards Bess from the Indian community, who criticize Bess's involvement in organizing an exhibition of cultural paraphernalia transported to Trinidad by early indentured laborers, amongst them Mona's great-grandmother. The criticism of Bess, however, is also based on her romantic liaison with Rajesh, the Rasta. This, you can see it on quote 8 on your handout. Despite this animosity from the community directed at her, Bess criticizes these representatives of Indian patriarchy in the community who articulate racial and ethnic intolerance in Trinidad. She says, "The real problem is how we fit into life here. You know, people talk about Trinidad culture and other culture called Indian culture. Coolie people wasn't people too? It's so ridiculous." Unquote. Conscious of, but unintimidated by, this narrow-minded pettiness, Bess forges ahead with her own professional and personal agenda of reclaiming Indian female indentured histories. Bess's confidence in herself as an Indo-Trinidadian woman, in her diverse family lineages, and her relationship to a Dugla partner, Rajesh, embody an Indo-Trinidadian female genealogy of insubordination and survival that she has recourse to, which Mona is still learning to access. These hidden maternal histories are instrumental in Mona's own subsequent revisioning of herself in Canada after her sojourn in Trinidad with Bess. This reinvention at the novel's close is founded on a Dugla sensibility, which Mona christens Karoni Dub. And that's on quote 10 on your handout. In this particular definition, Mona accesses her maternal histories, narrating her great-grandmother Gainda's secret love for Jeevan, an Indian man who fought to save her from a sexual attack on board ship, and who was incarcerated on an island off the African coast for his crime. Here, Mona alludes to the life-affirming potential of Dugla connections through her association of her foremother's love with the geographical space of Africa, where to all intents and purposes, this young woman leaves her heart. Interestingly, non-biological but cultural alliances between Afro-Caribbean and Indo-Trinidadian subjectivities are addressed in Shani Mutu's He Drowned She in the Sea, giving rise to a Dugla sensibility that echoes through the entire narrative. Mutu explores the complications of race and class in the relationships of her main characters, Harry St. George and Rose Sanga. The main focus, hence, is on the star-crossed heterosexual romance here. The episode, however, directly addressing African and Indian relations involves the male protagonist's father's courtship of his mother near the beginning of the novel. Sudhat St. George was adopted as a child by an Afro-Caribbean fisherman and his wife, Uncle Mako and Tante Eugenie. This sets him apart from the rest of the Indo-Caribbean community. Described from Dolly, Sudhat's wife's perspective, Sudhat is a more African than Indian. Mutu's premise in the novel is that Dugla identities need not be read as being produced purely on a biological level, hence resonating with Shalini Puri's remark that love between the two communities need not manifest itself in interracial sexual relations alone. Despite his obvious Indian phenotypical appearance, Sudhat is described as having the stereotypical characteristic of licentiousness and an implied hypersexuality associated with African men. Here, Dolly's seduction by Sudhat succeeds because of his difference, the fact that he was an Indian who wasn't an Indian, which then begs the question, what then is an Indian who is an Indian? I read Sudhat here as a Dugla figure of transgressive potential who does not recognize established ethnic boundaries and racial boundaries set out by Indo-Caribbean communities. Indeed, there is no reason for Sudhat to claim any form of loyalty to the Indo-Caribbean community if one were to consider that his parents had abandoned him when he was a child, the only legacy being left to him was his name. I name Sudhat. I'll shorten this a little. A disturbing element in the narrative is that Sudhat's Dugla presence is eradicated from the narrative universe. He drowns at sea in order to make room for other safer Indo-Caribbean subjectivities like his son, Harry, and Dolly herself, whose identity negotiations seem to focus on mainly class mobility and prejudices, which are informed by Indo-Caribbean histories of indentured labor. Okay, I'm going to shorten this as well. Kept apart for years by social conventions based on class observances, Harry and Rose meet again as adults and rekindle their passion for each other. They take the plunge, deciding to abandon their accustomed lives and socially acceptable selves behind. While planning his escape with Rose, Harry remembers his father and the stories of his disregard for social convention. I quote, "The drowned Sudhat St. George had taken his mother, or had he rescued her, kidnapped her, assisted her in leaving, away from her family whom she never saw again," unquote. Harry's paternal genealogy allows him to ponder the restrictions of the Indian community's perceptions of women as depicted in Rose's experience as an Indo-Caribbean woman, and the comparative freedom and independence his own mother enjoyed in her reinvention of herself after marrying Sudhat. Alongside his recovery of Rose, Harry also remembers his mother, Dolly, her efforts and courage in making life possible for them both after his father's untimely demise. It is Sudhat's Afro-Caribbean familial affiliations which finally make it materially possible for Harry and Rose to journey towards a new shared life together. Besides Sudhat's transgressive legacy of breaching racial and cultural boundaries, Harry also benefits from his adoptive grandfather, Mako's generosity and love. Mako furnishes him and Rose with a means to escape the constraints of their society, allowing them to travel to new spaces to reinvent themselves. Hence, Harry is not only given a practical means to reshape his new life with Rose, Mako also confers on him, through the gift of his boat and provisions, both his own and Sudhat's migratory genealogies from Africa and India, the Middle Passage and the Kalapani crossings, as a means of grounding himself in both these cultural contexts while bridging them. In The Swinging Bridge, the main protagonist, Mona, her maternal grandmother, Lily, and her cousin all push outward from a circumscribed Indian space to explore the possibilities of Dugla space. The Duglarized figures of Bess and Rajesh are able to negotiate fraught histories and racial relations in Trinidad, a national space which is defined through racial and cultural mixing. Mona's recovery of fragmented and silenced female genealogies allow her to reconnect to Trinidad, which effects a modicum of self-acceptance and re-evaluation of her cultural resources in her reinvention as a Canadian citizen with transcultural histories. Harry's paternal legacy of a mixed Afro-Caribbean and Indo-Caribbean sensibility allows him to think across established sociocultural boundaries where race or class in order to pursue and fulfill his social cultural boundaries of race or class in order to pursue and fulfill his desires. His upward social mobility, effected through his diasporic relocation to Canada and his profession as a successful landscape architect, allows him to reposition and reinvent himself in such a way that he's able to redress his previous social inequalities and rekindle his romance with Rose. And this, in turn, helps to instigate Rose's own reflections of her life situation as a respectable Indian wife and mother. She learns that she can attain some autonomy in shaping her life trajectory. While Espinay openly addresses miscegenation and Dugla identities, alongside hybridized cultural sensibilities and gendered contexts, Mutu's rendering of Dugla perspectives is more ambiguous in that she seems to skirt the issue of Duglarization by hinting at possible hybridities of personal choice and cultural sensibility rather than actual biological mixing. After the initially tantalizing prospect of a functioning Dugla identity, albeit not biologically produced, to have Sudhat killed off is a problematic aspect in the novel for me. Both novels re-evaluate Karabinius as a site for interracial collaborations, gender negotiations, and affirmation of negated identities. As writers who engage with their legacies of Indian indentured history in their artistic productions, Espinay and Mutu critique the social fractures among African and Indian communities and the social mobility of some at the expense of others. Here, hybridized sensibilities are validated, enabling transcultural interrogations, whereby radical resistance of racial binaries are paramount in their works. Thank you for your attention.